Aaron.
This is Paul.
This is Wayne.
And I'm Andrew.
You know, it's been kind of a rough week. You know, we had a funeral for an all-father. We had the death of the entire Justice League, and Neil Adams died. But you know, it would be really easy to lean into the darkness, the grimness of things that happened this week. But I got to kick it off by saying, Paul's dad still listens to the podcast. Woo!
We now know who our listener is.
Yeah, he's that one. Yeah. He's that one that listens on the first day.
Well, I think what's critical is that Paul's dad agrees with me. He too thought that the Batman and Catwoman had no chemistry. So there it is, Paul, in your face.
One out of two Pauls agrees with you.
Well, I just want you to know that from here on out, I'm talking to you, Big Paul. You're my audience. You're my guy. You're my guy out there.
Don't encourage him.
Every now and again, I'm going to be turning to camera and talking directly to you.
Directly to my dad.
When Aaron breaks the fifth wall, he's talking That's to right. Big Paul.
More than welcome to come on and tell us Paul stories.
Any embarrassing photos from his childhood, just send them right over to I Am Geek.
And I think it's important, you know, the usual Paul, our Paul, the Paul of Aaron and Pauly, he is not going to be here for the next 2 weeks. We can always have special guest Big Paul.
A Paul, as long as any Paul in the storm.
We've got to have a Paul. It's like Captain Kirk, how he's got to have a Vulcan for science officer. I've got to have a Paul.
I need a Paul. And if Big Paul knows how to edit, even better.
Yeah. And he's going to have to operate the video channel, too. So.
Exactly. He's going to have to maintain that YouTube channel while I'm out of town.
Yeah. You got to practice the hey, peeps.
Peeps.
Peeps. Well, you know, in all seriousness, Neil Adams passed away yesterday at 80 years old, legend in the comic book industry. He is the guy who got the creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, their rights back. I mean, he was key in advocating for their rights. He is a guy, I mean, he was so iconic in the 70s. His cover work, you know, the covers for Superman, covers for Batman, the interiors and covers for Green Arrow, Green Lantern, and particularly the, you know, Hard Traveling Heroes series. He did the Muhammad Ali versus Superman book. I mean, his work was fantastic, and he's one of these guys. I mean, he could have and did for a time write his own ticket in comics, looked around and said, you know what, there's not a lot of money to be made here, and went off and did his whole thing in advertising and was very successful over there. This guy, I have always found him to be a little much in terms of his personality. But you cannot deny the man's impact on the business. And I'm number one, I was stunned that he was 80 years old because the guy looked fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that was very surprising to me. Neil Adams, excuse me. Yeah. Neil Young. Neil Young is a different guy entirely. No, Neil Adams, he just seemed perpetually in his 60s to me.
Yeah.
Like he just always looked, and perhaps, because the video footage, we saw video footage of him, I feel like relatively recently talking about the Superman, Shuster stuff, and or Shuster and Siegel stuff, and I feel like he looked pretty good there, and it wasn't that long ago. Maybe it was filmed earlier. I don't know, but regardless, I mean, it's a bummer. He is at 80 years old. He certainly has changed the comics industry, and we probably wouldn't even have the comics industry in the way that we have it now were it not for the influence of Neil Adams.
I mean, he was key to creator rights, in the early days. I mean, I just don't see that we would be nearly as far along that road if it wasn't for Neil Adams. And for that alone, I'm grateful, because that has allowed a lot more creativity in the industry.
Well, and
huge talent, huge impact on the industry. Was a shame he's a jerk in person, but you can't deny his impact.
His contributions were critical. But I got to say, speaking of Neil Young, when I first saw Aaron send that message about, hey, Neil Adams died, in my brain, the first thing I thought of was Neil Dalton. I was like, Neil Dalton died.
Oh, no. Now we've lost 50% of our listenership between Neil and our dad and my dad.
So I'm glad that Neil Dalton's apparently alive and well. But yeah,
as is Neil Young.
Probably need to do a safety check on Neil, though.
Yeah. Neil, all
now that you say it, I haven't gotten a tweet from him today, so I'm a little concerned.
Right, well, Neil, let us know you're safe. Yeah. But yeah, it's sad to see him pass, but certainly had a long life, and you know, made great contributions to the field.
Yeah, including Absolutely. We're not going to talk about it this week, but Shadow War, you know, mm-hmm. wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Neil Adams creating Ra's al Ghul.
And I tell you, his Ra's al Ghul is the definitive Ra's
Absolutely.
Al Ghul for me.
Absolutely. Well, him and Norman Brayfogle for me, but...
You know, Raj and Batman sword fighting, Batman without a shirt on, but still has his cowl on.
Yeah.
That is so badass. I love those books.
That's how
and
I go to bed.
Talia,
that's how I sword amazing. Fight. I sword fight without a shirt, but with my cowl still on.
That's true. That's true. I've seen it. I've got the video.
Well, speaking, and not to move away from such a serious topic, but, you know, speaking of shirtless characters with masks, it was announced this week that Marvel has cast Bad Bunny in a movie based on the comic character El Muerto.
El Muerto.
Well, I shouldn't say Marvel. Sony. Let me clarify.
There you go. Yeah.
Sony. Yeah. In their expansion of their Spider-Man universe and plucking at every shitty character that's ever existed in Spider-Man comics, has decided Bad Bunny should play El Muerto in El Muerto.
You know, I had two major questions when I heard this news article. First is, who's Bad Bunny? The second is, who's El Muerto?
El Muerto.
I feel like El Muerto, he's a relatively recent character. He was introduced during the Scarlet Spider era, I think. I mean... Admittedly, it's a character I'm not terribly familiar with. If it feels like they're really grasping at straws there. And Bad Bunny, I think he's a DJ or a singer.
He is a singer, I believe.
Okay.
He's a recording artist of some shape or form. I actually have one or two of the songs in my playlist, but I don't know if he's a DJ or what. But he is a recording artist of some shape or form.
Bad Bunny is a Puerto Rican rapper, singer, record producer, actor, and professional wrestler. So he brings with him his wrestling talent to the movie.
Much like John Cena?
Much like John Cena.
Much like, yeah.
Almost exactly.
Apparently in the comics, El Muerto is a wrestler whose powers are handed down by ancestry in the form of a mask.
El Muerto.
Well, he's a luchador. That sounds right up Aaron's alley, actually.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Superpowered wrestler.
Apparently, he was in Narcos. He was also in Fast and Furious 9, playing the vital role of Lookout.
And now he's going to be in another movie that I'll never watch.
Yeah, it's an odd choice. It's an odd choice, Sony.
You know, Sony's commitment to keeping their foot in the door on the Marvel business is sad and amusing all at the same time.
They are just plucking at, like, what's next?
I don't understand why they just don't say to Marvel, as Marvel has said to them, let us make your movies, you get a cut, you know? Let us make those movies. And I know that Kathleen Kennedy, and that's not Kathleen Kennedy over there. Who? What's her name?
Amy Pascal.
I can't remember the producer. Yeah, I think that's right. She got horribly offended when they first said that about Spider-Man. But, you know, those movies have been huge. Why wouldn't you let Marvel do the thing that they do so well?
Well, and I'm going to be a little blunt here. I don't know why they bother with anything other than Spider-Man movies, quite frankly. It's not like Morbius, you know, tore up the charts, other than,
you know
there's a lot
Morbius
of memes
did,
about it. But,
but the Morbius, first Venom did pretty good.
But Morbius failed Fair. To perform because Morbius is a bad movie.
Well,
there is a good story to tell about Morbius, but you do it in a larger context of the Midnight Suns, right? You don't just have your little one-off Morbius film with Jared freaking Leto. You know, you make a real film, or you do it as a TV show, which is really the place to do it because you need deeper and longer storytelling for that character.
I think they're trying to recapture the first Venom because it did pretty good for them.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, now that you mention it, they did announce that this week at CinemaCon, it was announced that there is a third Venom movie coming. So,
not surprised at all.
And another Ghostbusters movie. That one is surprising to me because
Afterlife was good.
Yeah,
Afterlife was great and it did really well.
Afterlife was okay.
Come on, Paul. I agree with you, Paul. It's okay.
Yeah,
you guys. I was underwhelmed by Afterlife.
I was. Whelmed.
You need to get whelmed, Aaron.
Well, you know, Aaron.
They wildly underused the adults in that movie.
I
think that's the point. I think it was a movie designed more for a younger audience.
I don't disagree,
but that's a different franchise for me.
I agree. I mean, I completely agree. But if you're going to have Paul Rudd in a movie, do something worthwhile with him, and they just didn't.
Yeah.
And I mean, you should cast somebody else. And I didn't. I have a lot of issues around some of the stuff that happens, like, you know, with the two gargoyles, you know, Paul Rudd becomes one, the mother becomes one, and just how that works on the screen versus how it worked in the original Ghostbusters movie. I just thought it was fine. I was entertained lightly. I thought the kids were great, and I thought the action with the kids was great. I didn't think the adult stuff worked.
Yeah. I probably won't rewatch it until the next one comes out.
Yeah.
Now, Aaron, what level of whelm did Moon Knight Episode 5 leave you in? Because apparently, the writer of Moon Knight went on Twitter and said Episode 5 is the episode. Even though they said that about Episode 4, they also said it about Episode 5. They said, secrets will be revealed. It'll blow your mind. Now, I'm still on Episode 1, so I still have 4 episodes to catch up on. But how is Episode 5?
So, Episode 5 was not the Moon Knight I wanted. However, I thought it was a really good, very tense story. I thought the payoff was worthwhile and a bit surprising. I don't want to spoil anything because it would be so easy to ruin the episode. But I thought that it took what I thought was a very ridiculous ending to Episode 4. And really, they didn't redeem that ridiculous ending, but it went on from there and became, instead of a very silly episode, which is what I was expecting, was just more and more dramatically tense as it ratchets up throughout the episode. And not in a way that I would have expected or wanted, but it was actually a really good story. I would complain about my objections to the content of the series not being at all what I expected it to be or what I felt like was pitched to me. However, I found Episode 5 unique in the series so far in that it was very satisfying.
Yeah, if you go back to when we were talking about the show before it came out, I think both Aaron and myself were like, well, I hope they don't lean too hard into the dissociative identity disorder that he has. Well, Episode 5 goes way even deeper into the dissociative identity disorder that he has. And I mean, I agree with Aaron. After that horrible last 15 minutes of Episode 4, I had very low expectations. Maybe that helped.
I agree.
Yeah. And Episode 5 was really very good. It wasn't what I was looking for. Wasn't what I wanted. But it was a very good episode.
Now I'm kind of interested because that is my favorite part of Moon Knight. And it was the only thing I really cared for in the first episode.
You probably like Episode 5.
Yeah, you'll be in the pocket on this one then, because it very much lives in that space and does a really strong job of telling an origin story that you didn't understand you were getting at the time.
Yep.
Right? I mean, you're just like, oh, okay. Like I said, Episode 5 was not the episode I deserved, but it was the episode I needed.
I mean, I think you could probably say, even though it's not the content I was looking for, I think you could easily say Episode 5 is the best episode so far.
Oh, far and away. far and away, both visually, both in terms of storytelling and direction. You cannot fault the artistic direction on this show.
There's some beautiful cinematography on this one.
Absolutely. I love the sailing on a sea of sand. That was just gorgeous. And like I said, the ending of this episode was stunning to me.
Yep.
It really took my breath away. I was not expecting anything like that. And, I wasn't expecting something meaningful. Right. I mean, I was really taken away by that.
You weren't expecting something to make you feel emotions.
Correct. I mean, when was the last time that happened
on a Moon Knight show? Yeah, I know.
In general, like, really?
Yeah, I'm dead inside.
So now next week is episode 6.
The final.
Paul, are you going to get caught up and watch? You said you're going to watch them all once they're all out. Next week's the week. Are you going to do it?
I am. And but we're not podcasting next week. So yes. I'll fill you in next time on Funny Books with Aaron and Polly. But we can talk about some different news in that this week, actually, I think yesterday, it was announced that both Batwoman and Legends of Tomorrow have been canceled at the CW network.
And nothing of value was lost.
I have watched exactly 0 episodes of both those shows.
Same.
I watched the entire first season of Batwoman and the first couple episodes of the second. And I watched the first 3 seasons of Legends of Tomorrow before dropping it.
I watched the only episodes of those shows that I've watched are the ones that participated in, like, the Crisis crossover. If those, I think they had episodes that participated in those crossovers. Like you said, I don't think anything, obviously jobs are lost and that kind of stuff. But as far as entertainment value, nothing's really lost here.
Yeah, I watched like the first 6 episodes or so, maybe more than that, of Batwoman in the first season. And it was terrible. And then, of course, they lost the lead actor in Batwoman.
Yeah.
And brought in someone new, but yet continued on for seasons 2 and 3. And I just, that show wasn't good to begin with, and there really wasn't much to redeem there. I never have enjoyed Legends of Tomorrow, except for an unusual crossover episode that I might enjoy.
Yeah.
But Legends of Tomorrow has always been subpar, in my opinion. The only show over there that I felt like had any real legs to it, pun intended, was Flash. But even, the previous season of Flash was just awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have not watched anything this season.
Yeah. And this next one might be its last season. I think they're wrapping up a lot of this stuff. And, unfortunately, apparently Legends of Tomorrow ended on a cliffhanger featuring Booster Gold. But,
well, it would not surprise me to see that rolls into a remaining existing CW show.
Yeah, because
exactly. They have been very, very generous with the storytelling over there, giving fans exactly what they want. I don't think they leave that hanging on the tree. But I got to ask, clearly, the Flash TV show is coming up on it, probably its final season.
Potential of seeing Gorilla Grodd again isn't enough to get me to watch the show.
Well, given the state of Ezra Miller, right? He's a train wreck. And that DC or Warner's doesn't want to, commit a whole lot to this guy. I think there is a real strong case to have on film some sort of multiverse mix-up in the end credits of the Flash movie. And swap out your Barrys with CW Barry. I'm sorry, I like the guy. I think he is really well cast for that role, and I think that would be a neat way to retain your audience on the films. And seriously, what do you have to lose?
I enjoy the Grant Gustafson Flash a lot.
Yeah,
I haven't watched the last few seasons, but I do like him. But I will say, when we watched the Fandom. Do you remember the energy Grant was giving off when he was doing his bits? Oh,
absolutely. He looked like none. He'd rather be anywhere. But, yes. You make him a great big movie star. I bet he gets excited about that. Plus, only having to shoot that every other year or so also is probably going to make him pretty excited.
Fair point.
I just think, you know,
that energy won't go to Hawaii and get in fights and beat people.
Yeah,
he doesn't have the energy for that.
I think you make it an in-story substitution, you know, and you have Grant Gustin show up and everyone's like, who the hell are you? I'm Barry Allen. I've always been Barry Allen.
I mean, with the whole rise of the multiverse, both on the Marvel, yes, and on all sides of comic book movies, you know, I think audiences would be much more accepting of that possibility than they used to be.
I agree. Rather than having to reboot the whole damn thing.
I don't know. I feel like just get rid of both of them at this point. DC.
Both
DC.
Marvel and DC?
Just get rid of Grant. I mean, Grant Gustin, he's on his way out. He's been playing the character for... What season are they rolling into? Eight?
I think it's 30 years eight? Now.
I think it's 30 years. Yeah, 30 years. Like, get rid of Grant Gustin. He's been playing the role for 8 years. You know, get rid of Ezra Miller. You know, just start fresh. It's... DC is really struggling between Amber Heard and Ezra Miller. I think they need to recast some of their core crew there.
Honestly, I think with the Discovery buyout, they need to just start over. Scrap it all, start from scratch. It doesn't look like they're going to do that, but yeah. I think that would be best.
And I'm a Snyderverse fan, but like, it's over. Just reboot. Well,
I just think that The Flash gives you an in-story solution to your actor problem. And you don't have to, even if you didn't want to have Grant Gustin for, you know, your forever Flash, you could just do it for one, you know, and while you recast and figure that crap out.
You could just recast The Flash every movie.
I'd be down for that, to be perfectly honest. He'd be
like the new Doctor Who.
Yeah, it'd be like Kenny. It. Oh my God, they killed Kenny. Like they killed Barry.
I'm excited. I mean, I hate to say that. I'm excited that Batwoman got canceled. I'm excited that
that's a horrible thing, but funny.
It is a terrible thing to say, but I mean, those shows are awful.
Yeah, and the only CW show that counts is Superman and Lois.
Yeah, that is damn straight. Wayne, did you watch it this week?
Oh yeah.
I gotta tell you, you know, when they revealed that they were going to do a Bizarro story, I was bracing myself because, you know, those really tend to be silly. And I don't like my Superman and Lois silly. I mean, I like in-character comedy, but I don't like silly. And I got to tell you, I am loving the Bizarro story. And when the cube-shaped Earth of Bizarro World showed up, I about squealed in delight.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase at one point, what on square Earth?
Yeah.
And you noticed all through the episode, everything that would typically be round, like glasses were square, but that wasn't that big of a deal. A whole bunch of other things just happened to be
shooting
square.
Pool with instead of balls, cubes. Yeah, yeah, it was great. It was just great seeing the variances. I mean, you know, it's bizarre.
I love Jonathan.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, it's Bizarro World, so everything's, you know, backwards. So, you know, Clark has a good relationship with his Kryptonian half-brother, Tal, which, I mean, it was just so cool to see on screen. And you know, because this is a Bizarro World, you know, John Henry Irons did not come to this universe. You know, he came to, you know, the regular universe that we see. So, you know, you don't have the John Henry Irons experience. You've just got all of this different stuff going on. I was very interested in it. And the fact that, you know, Jordan is the one without powers. John has the powers. And Jordan, I mean, is almost an afterthought in the Bizarro World. I mean Jordan has like three lines in the entire episode.
Yeah, and John has so many more powers than Jordan at this point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I, you know, and of course we're in the next episode we're going to get a Jordan John fight. That's happening.
Yeah.
Right. And I can't wait to see it. This show is so good. The production values are great, the direction is great. The redemption of the Army Colonel in this episode was so earned. I was just so surprised at the maturity of the writing. You know, it is writing I don't expect to see on the CW.
I love the costuming. Lana's costume as Hal's wife
or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that costume.
Yeah. And her costume as slutty bartender, right? I really dug the episode, and I'm just like, damn, this is so good. I can't get over how good this show is. It's like those CW shows grew up.
Well, yeah, that one stuff. Anyway.
And they need to stay away from this CW show.
Right.
That's right. That is right.
Well, you know, I'm going to rearrange the outline a little bit.
No!
I know. But, you know, it feels right that since we're talking about Superman and Lois, we should talk about the death of the Justice League.
Yeah, they're dead.
They're dead. I mean, clearly, there's no way back from this.
They've been dead to me for years.
I'd like to tell a story here. You know, when my grandfather died, we had his funeral, and not 7 minutes into the wake after the funeral that people were revealing Grandpa's deepest, darkest secrets. I mean, you know, Grandpa had been married before. None of us knew that, but his brother's like, oh yeah, he was married before he married Pearl, you know? And I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And that's what I want to see about the Justice League. I want to hear all the stories that were always secrets that we never got to hear. I want those in subsequent issues.
See, I thought you were going to say that not 7 minutes into his funeral, he came back. Because that's kind of what I expect from this funeral for the Justice League.
There's only one character that I can think of that I think may have actually died in the issue.
Green Arrow?
And that's Ollie. Yeah, Green Arrow got crushed by Doomsday. So yeah, he might actually be dead.
Nah, but he might actually be dead. Do you hear yourself in comic book world? That's not a thing.
Well, he'll get better. He's been dead before.
He'll be dead the longest, I guess we should say. But like, nothing in this book made me feel like the Justice League actually died. This really just feels like the start of a storyline, not the death of the Justice League.
Well, I think that's what it is. I mean, if this were a thing, they would be doing more marketing, right? You know, it would look more like Death of Superman, you know? And they're not doing that. We don't have this, you know, there wasn't a deep media push for this, you know? I didn't see any of the level of media around this. And, you know, arguably, it's a lot easier to do media today than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, I saw a decent amount of media on this. I will say, I do think they pushed this in like USA Today and that kind of stuff, but I feel like they're going to, one, half of these characters are still alive in their core books.
Right.
Right. And will continue to be. As far as I know, there is no intent on Batman ever not being Bruce Wayne in his book during this time period of this storyline. So
they've said that this is taking place in the slight future, and the books will catch up to it at some point.
Yeah, I don't know that I buy it. I feel like by the time it'll catch up in some of the books, they'll be back. So
there'll be new creators.
Yeah.
Who won't want to tell that story.
Yeah. Nothing about this book, really. Yeah.
I do accept why the characters would think that they are dead. You know, the one character that comes back didn't really understand that Barry's in his own alternate reality of Pleasantness or Nightmare, whichever one Barry's in. So he legitimately thinks that they're dead, and he's the one that brings the message back. So from a story standpoint, I can accept everyone thinking they're dead, even though we as a reader never think for a second they're dead.
Well, let's just be honest. I mean, this is comics. And, you know, we are all, you know, people who've been reading comics for literal decades. We know that these guys aren't dead, and they're never gonna be truly dead. You know, it's just a matter of how effectively are you telling the story. I can accept that people think they're dead. I mean, we certainly see them, you know, either disintegrated or reverted to, you know, accelerated to bones on the page. I accept that they're taken off the board for however long. You know, you don't have to convince me that they're going to die, because you can't convince me that they're going to die, because this is comics. That really doesn't happen in Marvel and DC books, unless you're Captain Marvel.
Yeah. And considering how easily they were dispatched, you know, like Pariah, right? Pariah has put together his dark army of all the greatest villains of DC history possessed by the great darkness. So you've got Darkseid and Eclipso and Doomsday and all that stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, but in the end, he's the one who kills the Justice. quote unquote, kills the Justice League with a snap of his finger. So I'm like, well, why did you need the Dark Army? You could have done this at any time. But much like, I feel like what he's done is the same thing that he did with Flash. He's basically snapped them into their own, like, ideal realities.
I need to correct you on something. Oh. Pariah did not snap his fingers.
He did not.
He killed them with jazz hands.
He did. Jazz hands. That'll be the new thing. Instead of snapping, jazz hands.
That's right.
Deadly jazz hands.
Maybe spirit fingers.
For what it's worth, the book read fine. You know, I've been reading the Justice League Incarnate stuff, and, it kind of led to this. And whatever book was before Justice League Incarnate, I don't remember what the one was that led up to that book. So, I mean, the book, great art. I thought the art by Daniel Semper was beautiful. Yeah,
it's a good-looking book.
Yeah.
It's a really good-looking book.
It is a fine Justice League story. It's just that these stakes, are more artificial feeling than a normal book. Like, you know, sometimes we, like you said, it's comics. We know characters don't stay dead. Mm-hmm. But like in this one, you don't even, you know, isn't the rule you have to see the body?
Right.
Really, in this book, the only body you saw was Ollie's, right? Like, this felt more artificial than most comic book deaths.
Honestly, DC's events, and Marvel's had this issue lately too, when they go to this multiverse cosmic level, I never feel the stakes anymore because you can just pull another one out of the multiverse.
It's been done too much.
Yeah.
I mean, the multiverse crises on either side of the business, they're just too big and too often. You know, I think the reason why, you know, Crisis on the Infinite Earths works so well, number one, it was a full year plus for them to tell the story, and it crossed over into every single book, and it impacted every single book, and it changed the way they wrote comics.
Yeah.
That Crisis on the Infinite Earths had the virtue of never being done before, and that it impacted the entire line of business at DC Comics. Well, you can't emulate that without impacting your entire line and also doing something that's never been done before. And oh yeah, by the way, having the best writer and the best artist in the business ever working on the book, you know. And while this is a very nice looking book, and I was entertained by it, you know, I didn't buy into it as I think DC Comics would like me to do, but you know, I'm also a jaded comic book reader. This book was never going to surprise someone who's read any of the other previous Crises books, right?
Yeah,
you're just never going to be surprised.
They keep trying to up the ante over what they've done before.
Yeah.
And they need to realize that that's not what they need to do. A strong story-driven, character-driven, you know, where you don't have these bigger and badder, oh, one villain's not enough. Here's all of your villains all together at once. No.
So, you know, when I think about the big event book at DC Comics that has worked well, obviously Crisis on the Infinite Earths. I really like Infinite Crisis. I think Infinite Crisis is a really well done book, and it's a really strong, well conceived sequel to Crisis on the Infinite Earths. I mean, it's the sequel that I never thought we needed, never thought we'd have, and yet it's really, in many respects, certainly the core books, a perfect story.
And I think so Flashpoint, personal.
Yeah, I think Flashpoint is also, you know, sort of a surprising book because I don't think they set out for Flashpoint to be as important as it wound up being.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's one of those books that again really surprised you, and you know, the stakes weren't huge in that. Everything's taking place in an altered, you know, universe, you know, so you can do all kinds of crazy things. But it was so imaginative and it was so off the shelves, and it brought us Thomas Wayne. Right. I really,
for better or worse. But yes,
Thomas Wayne in those books, Thomas Wayne in the was it The Button?
Yeah, The Button.
Was that the book, The Button? You know, where we saw him in relation, in direct relation, really written by Geoff Johns, I think, he was perfect. I thought that was we got just enough of him, right?
Yeah, they've done horrible things with the character since, but he came on strong.
Yeah, but you know, those books have wound up being very important. I mean, it's rolled into that new Flash movie with Ezra Miller. You know, that you're going to see elements of that. We've seen elements of it in Flash on the CW. It's wound up being an important, you know, seminal sort of story. I have a hard time believing that this thing that we read this week is going to be that. Not that I didn't enjoy it. It was a fine book, but it's not going to be of the level and of the caliber of those other big events.
Yeah. And I think,
you know, I remember back when Superman died and I had my argument with the local comic shop owner. He's like, it's a gimmick. Well, that gimmick has stood the test of time.
It has.
We are still celebrating that story literal decades later. I'm not sure that that's going to be the case with this story.
No, this is going to be forgotten next year.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong.
We will not be talking about it.
This year. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to pick up Dark Crisis. You know, I think it'll be an interesting story. I'll at least give it a shot. But yeah, I think, you know, I'm looking at DC, like, genuine crossovers. And, you know, I mean, there are things on here that I wouldn't necessarily consider. Like, DC Rebirth was a great one shot, but I think as far as event books, the last one that really impacted the greater DC universe in a significant way was Convergence, which was pretty good actually. But I mean,
good stuff flowed out of
it. Yeah, good stuff flowed out of it. Same with like Forever Evil, I think was the last real one that was, I mean, it was decent quality, but yeah, I mean, to your point, I think we're really back to Flashpoint before we, you know, anything that has had lasting stakes. And much like, unless I think what this will lead into is we'll get an interesting story in Dark Crisis. I certainly feel like Dark Crisis will be more palatable than Death Metal. This is one of the seminal DC crossovers.
Yeah, I really dislike all the Death Metal stuff. And honestly, I don't know that we're going to get a good story out of Dark Crisis. I have zero faith in that.
I like Josh Williamson. So, I mean, we'll see. Well, I mean, I think we'll find out relatively soon.
And I mean, Joshua Williamson, he had like four books out this week, right?
Yeah, he did. We're only talking about one of them. But he also had the Deathstroke, the Robin, and there was one other one. I don't remember off the top of my head. But yeah. Oh, and the Rogues. You know, so he had four pretty big books this week. You know, and it's funny because we're talking about, you know, this is a very death-heavy podcast, but we're talking about death and, you know, and how the Justice League death doesn't feel real. Well, let's talk about a book where the death is already essentially undone in the moment of the death, which is Odin's death in the pages of Thor. You know, in Thor issue 23, Odin sacrificed himself because Mjolnir had become sentient and was betraying Thor, and, you know, Odin sacrificed himself, but then immediately his soul is trapped in Mjolnir now. But in Thor issue 24, we get the, you know, also Legacy issue 750, we get Funeral for the Allfather, you know, featuring stories by Jason Aaron, Dan Pastoris, Al Ewing, Lee Garbett, Dan Jurgens, Walter Simonson, J. Michael Straczynski, Olivier Coppiel, as well as Donny Cates and Nick Klein.
With art by Mahmoud Azrar and Matt Wilson, Junie Ba, Pascal Ferry, and lots of others, Klaus Janson, Dan Jurgens, Alex Malib, Declan Shalvey. I mean, it is Walt Simonson. I mean, it is a murderer's row of artists on this book. And I usually hate these jam books. You know, that usually winds up being a lot of short story vignettes that don't really sew together well. I dug this thing a lot.
Did you
really enjoyed this book? I did.
I did not.
I'm sorry to hear that. I thought, number one, I thought the artwork was gorgeous throughout. I mean, just gorgeous. The funeral procession for Odin with the celestials and the watcher watching from the horizon. Mm-hmm. You zoom in and you've got, you know, all of these, you know, supporting characters and whatnot, villains, etc., from the Thor books. And then you've also got the Avengers, you know, the Silver Surfer. I mean, it reminds me of one of those, you know, great George Perez posters with, you know, the entire Marvel marching, you know, heroes, you know, kind of thing. It was very much that. It was sort of an homage to the way we used to draw comics. I really dug the funeral procession. I gotta say, I enjoyed all of the stories in this book. Was a little surprised at some of the supporting characters that we didn't see show up, like, you know, Frog Thor.
Mm-hmm.
I thought for sure we would see some Frog Thor.
Yeah, that spread is still untouched, right? That Frog Thor thing that they set up.
Yeah, but I enjoyed the you know revisiting the Beta Ray Bill origin story. I'm a sucker for Walt Simonson drawn spaceships, particularly Scuttlebutt. I very much enjoyed that. It harkened back to that old Marvel storyline where Thor was traveling the galaxy with the Recorder, you know, the alien space robot who, you know, records everything for posterity. And so we got a glimpse back at those times. And I gotta say, I loved that because I always enjoyed the Recorder. This was just very much scratching sort of a Thor nostalgia itch for me. I dug it. I thought this book was great.
Yeah,
I didn't care for any of the stories.
Really?
I thought the art was great. I liked seeing these eras again.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was the connecting tissue of it that I just didn't care for. But no, I didn't like anything in this book.
I do gotta say, I have to say, I felt like one of the eras that was missing. Well, a couple of eras that were missing. We didn't get to see anything from the Eric Masterson era where he was Thor, but prior to him becoming Thunderstrike.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get to see anything from the era that Dan Jurgens drew where Thor was king, right? Where Asgard hovered over New York City. We didn't get to see any of that.
Well, I think
I felt like there was...
Sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
I was just saying, I felt like there were some things that were missing from the book, but overall I enjoyed it a great deal.
Yeah, I think what we, if you read the description of the next issue, they said there's going to be bonus stories, including one by Thor Legends Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz, as the celebration of the God of Thunder's 60th anniversary continues. So I think we're going to get backup stories featuring kind of some of the, you know, the different eras of Thor throughout the year. So I think, you know,
with
some of the
increased price to go with it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think some of the stuff that you may be looking for, Aaron, may still be coming. Maybe just didn't fit in this issue kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big book. I mean, it was 62 pages. Yeah. I mean, good grief.
No, I not to belabor the point. I didn't love the book. I felt like some of the stories were good. Some of the stories were not so good. For me, the connective thread didn't work. I liked the starting piece of the book. I really don't like the way Nick Klein draws Loki, like kind of this frail 70-something-year-old man.
To that point, I don't much care for the way he draws Thor either.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about that in the previous book that, you know, some of the acting that he puts Thor through makes Thor look like a wimp.
Yeah.
You know, he looks like a big whiny baby.
But my biggest disappointment was the Straczynski story. That's what I was looking forward to, and I wanted to see more. I wanted to see the town. I wanted to see the supporting characters from that era, and instead we get a lawyer and a room.
Yeah, that was not... I was hopeful for more on that, but for me, I'm going to say this. I'm probably going to regret saying this. I'm out on Thor because of the last page. I know I've been hedging on this book for a while now, basically building up to this issue. But at the end of the book, Odin reveals that, you know, the reason he's trapped in Mjolnir is he went to Valhalla and the gates of Valhalla have been broken open and Valhalla is no more. And for me, that was the straw that broke the back for me on this book, because I don't know how many times I need to read the same story from Donny Cates at this point. You know, like, oh, Thor went to where Donald Blake was. Oh, Donald Blake's reality is no more. Oh, Mjolnir is no more. And it's like, okay, dude, like, I get it. Basically, you're going to take something that's iconic to the character and break it at the start of every storyline. And I'm done with that story, I think.
I don't have a problem with Odin's soul being, you know, inside Mjolnir, you know, given that, particularly now that we know that, you know, Mjolnir is inhabited by, you know, some preternatural storm god, right? I think that makes sense for Odin's soul to temper what's going on inside the hammer, you know, and I think that's interesting. I agree that I'm tired of all of the inner drama within Asgard and the Asgardian realms that they control. Like Valhalla is the place for the Asgardian gods to retire to upon death. That bothers me. It's just, it seems too internal, and I want the stories to be more external. I want some internal storytelling, but I don't need it to be our systems have all fallen apart. I need it to be.
And you know what it's going to mean. The gates to Valhalla are destroyed. No one is there. That means anyone they want to bring back from the dead is just coming back.
Well, it's just super frustrating. You know, I feel like we keep spinning these same stories. Now, I'm not saying we're spinning these same stories over the course of 60 years. I'm saying we're spinning these same stories over the course of 18 months. You know, it's just the recency is ridiculous. And I'd really prefer, I think the thing that we're missing with Thor is his engagement with his fellow gods and his engagement on Earth. And then there's no balance there in that storytelling. It's always shit on Asgard has fallen apart and we've got to deal with that without
him. That's why I love Straczynski's run so much.
Yeah.
You got the gods and you got Earth.
Yeah. That's missing. So Banner of War, what do we know about this?
It's just a crossover between the two Donny Cates books because he's also writing Hulk.
Gotcha. Okay, so it's not a big, it's not just, it's, is it a big event or is it just through the Donny Cates books?
Yeah, it's just through Hulk and Thor. So there's, I think, a one-shot and then it'll cross over between the two books. And I'm, unless you guys tell me that it's the bomb.com, I'm out.
I would never say those words, Paul.
Oh, I totally would. In fact, that's my new catchphrase. It's the bomb.com.
It's the bomb.com. Yeah, I'm definitely out on Thor. And I will tell you, Aaron, I struggled a little bit with this week's issue of Punisher.
Really?
While I enjoyed it much, honestly, it's kind of like the Thor book. It's like there's always, there was one thread in this that I really didn't connect with. And unfortunately, whereas in Thor, it was on the last page. In Punisher, it was on the first page, where Punisher talks about, you know, he's with the school guidance counselor and they're talking about his you know, so he this is 12-year-old Frank
Castle. I don't know what you're reading, but on the first page of my copy of the Punisher, he's making out with his dead wife.
This is prior to the credits page, where he's right, with a therapist. And like, what book are you reading? I'm reading Punisher XXX. Frank Castle is, you know, he talked, it's 12-year-old Frank Castle, and they talk about how he's been collecting roadkill and reading gun magazines and how he's killed a man already at 12 years old and he's got a knife hidden in his teddy bear. And I'm like, I don't know. For me, the Punisher, no, don't get me wrong. It's not like I'm an expert in all things Punisher, though I did read a good amount of Punisher in the 90s. And I don't, you know, turning him into basically, you know, kind of a serial killer, you know, that all the threads of a serial killer. For me, what Frank Castle went to Vietnam or whatever war they want to put him in, given the time frame, you know, now, as a good man and came out a damaged man. You know, from the war. I mean, but turning him into a 12-year-old who collects roadkill and dead animals and, you know, is obsessed with hurting things at 12 years old, that really took something from the character that I didn't care for that. I really didn't care for that turn in that, for Frank Castle.
I completely understand what you're saying. My understanding of the Frank Castle character is that Frank Castle idealized Captain America, Steve Rogers, and you know, went to Vietnam to serve his country as Steve Rogers went to war to serve his country, and you know, came back certainly with some issues post Vietnam, as many of our returning veterans did, but was made better through the relationship with his wife. And when his wife and family were murdered, he became a much darker person, and he became the person that, you know, Steve Rogers didn't become.
Yeah,
right.
You exactly.
Know, he went another direction. I too have issues with characterizing Frank Castle with traits and elements that are common to the worst serial killers. But I suspect this is not a reliable narrator we're getting. Mm-hmm. I feel like we will find that some of this has been put on Frank, that this is not actually how he grew up. That's my headcanon in this.
Yeah.
I feel like there is manipulation going on, and we see some of that in the book.
We do.
And certainly he's being manipulated, you know, by the hand, having his dead wife back to life.
But the manipulation of the hand from his childhood on, that's a retcon that I struggle with a little bit.
Same. I'm curious about that. And, you know, I enjoyed the way the story was told, and I particularly enjoy putting the Punisher at odds with Ares. And I liked how Ares was depicted in the book. I'm in for it. I'm enjoying the book. I can understand your qualms with it, but I'm going to give it a little bit more slack because I very much enjoyed what I read.
And I'm going to continue with it. And the art is beautiful. I mean, the art is absolutely gorgeous. You know, for me,
the back and forth nature.
Yeah, and the forth nature of it works. It works, and it flows. I think what it reads like to me is that they are intentionally trying to make the Punisher a level of unlikable that people who have idolized that symbol will no longer idolize him because he's just a horrible person, and he has been, you know, basically modeled by the hand to be the Antichrist his entire life or something. Like, it just kind of feels like that a little bit to me, but I'm going to continue with it. Yeah, we're only 2 issues into a 12-issue storyline, and I'm certainly, you know, I certainly will go in with an open mind. It's just, I definitely struggled with some of the things in this issue, as I did with Amazing Spider-Man, issue 1. This is the new relaunch of the next volume of Amazing Spider-Man. The last long arc was, I think, by Nick Spencer, had a murderer's row of artists, to use your words, Aaron. Now we've got Zeb Wells and John Romita Jr. And for me, this is going to be shocking. The only thing that worked for me in this book was the John Romita Jr. art. I hated the writing on this book. And I even like Zeb Wells, but wow, I just did not care for anything in this book. But Andrew, Wayne, I know you guys also read it.
So I'm going to need some help from Wayne on this one. I've been out on Spider-Man since Dan Slott left the title. So how much of all these changes, Wayne, are new for this book, and how much has already been established in the Nick Spencer run?
So the last couple of arcs, the debt that he has for the medical stuff.
Yeah.
That was the beginning of the last arc with where Ben Reilly took over.
Right, subbed in for him. That's how they took him off the stage while Ben Reilly subbed.
Radiation poison. He was in the hospital for a long time. Him and Randy became roommates during the Spencer run. What other change?
What's Aunt May all upset with him? Is that something out of the Nick Spencer
run? That's something new.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so the mystery is, what did Peter do to piss everyone off?
Yes, and that's the big thing, is where we ended the last run, Peter had just come back. Him and Mary Jane were moving in together. He was happy. Aunt May had gone to bed, and him and Aunt May had a great relationship, and she even went to Doc Ock to help get him cured for his radiation poisoning.
Okay.
And well, it ended in a very positive, happy note, except for the fact that it once again destroyed Ben Reilly's character in the last issue. But from a Peter standpoint, it wrapped up very positive for him. And this starts off with him in that crater and no idea why.
Yeah, so, I did not care. The John Romita Jr. art for me in this book was very uneven. So there were some scenes, like when he's talking to Randy early on, like the facial expressions do not match up with the emotions they seem to be trying to convey to each other.
Fair.
So yeah, there are parts of the John Romita Jr. art where I thought it was fine. It was okay. And there are parts where it bugged me. The storytelling, I kind of like the whole gangster vibe of you know, New York City. So seeing Tombstone and a lot of the other kind of Madame Mask and kind of the other organized crime Hammerhead folks from New York City, that was kind of cool. I enjoyed seeing that element kind of reintroduced for the story. But for the most part, I was kind of just confused since I'd been out of Spider-Man so long. I spent a lot of time going, huh. Don't know what's going on there.
Yeah,
so,
and actually, you know, you make a good point. I don't mind the crime stuff. You know, like Tombstone meeting with the other crime bosses, and, you know, cool. And the Kingpin's son. Like, that was good. Like, I actually like that stuff. I think the problem for me in the Spider-Man book was Spider-Man and Peter Parker. I just didn't like almost any scene with Peter Parker in
it. He's definitely kind of a jerk.
I will agree with Andrew that the Romita art was a hit or miss. I think he actually did a really good job when Spider-Man's in costume.
Yeah.
It's when he has to draw a face that's the problem. So as long as someone's wearing a mask, he can do serviceable art. But yeah, his style does not work for me at all on faces. But that was my big issue with this too, is Peter's a jerk.
Yep.
It's like whatever happened was a major thing that happened, but he is completely self-absorbed in this book.
Yeah.
He is writing off everyone around him. Torch is coming to check on him, and he's blowing him off and not jumping away. Randy is coming to check on him and ask for help.
He's a super jerk to Randy. I cannot believe it. That first few pages. Yeah.
Yeah. And I understand, kind of like the Punisher, we're only one issue in, and there's still a lot, and they're setting up a mystery. Like, why is Peter being an asshole? Why does Mary Jane have kids? Why are all these things happening? But for me, I'm not interested in seeing where the story goes. And if I were you, Wayne, after reading whatever, 50, 60 plus issues of Nick Spencer's art to see Peter and Mary Jane finally together again, literally for next month for them to be apart, I'd be pissed. I would be
especially the way they were doing that of she told them not to call. And yeah, no, and I get that what they're going to probably do is they'll be together by the end of the arc, and they're going to do all these big reveals, but I'm tired of that storytelling trope. I'm tired of the here's the big thing, and now we're not going to tell you what happened until who knows how long. I just want to enjoy the story as it's happening. Well, I don't want this big, what happened?
Yeah.
And if we want to talk about mysteries, you know, I assume Mary Jane wasn't pregnant at the end of the Nick Spencer run, right?
No.
And now she's got children who...
6 months later.
Well, no, but those are not 6-month-old children. I mean, you know, you'd say, six and, I don't know, three, maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
From the pictures.
I assume she's with whoever that guy is, and they're his kids.
Yeah, like that. Maybe she's their adopted mom. That it took me a second, too. I'm like, oh, we're dealing with reality altering. But then I'm like, oh, no, maybe they're just adopted kids. But still, 6 months is a short time for those kids to start calling her mommy.
Exactly.
Well, and if that's the case, though, they are really throwing us the red herring, because that little girl and her are drawn to have the exact same face.
Well, you know. That's John Romita. It's either John Romita Jr. or Paul, her new boyfriend, has a type. I think one of the things that bugged me about this book is kind of one of the things that bugged me about Thor. When I think about the books that I'm enjoying the most nowadays on stands, you know, things like Nightwing and books like that. One of the things that bugs me about this first issue of Spider-Man and continues to bug me about Thor is they literally just intentionally screw with the status quo every few issues. And I feel like, hey, you know, the status quo is called that because you actually establish it for a little bit and then turn it on its head. But if you turn the status quo over in every single story arc, then for me, that's just the illusion of change. And so I didn't care for this book.
Further, Paul, why does Nightwing work? Because Nightwing's character is moving forward.
Yeah.
He's progressing in his life. There are changes happening like crazy in that book, but they're organic and they grow out of him growing.
Yeah.
Versus changing the status quo by some just big event that happened or constantly having to reset everything. And this feels like another big reset.
Yeah. And comics just don't learn. And don't, we're a comic book podcast, and I love comics. But this, you know, this is, speaking of Nightwing, this is kind of Rick Grayson-y to me. You know, like, oh, all of a sudden Peter Parker's an asshole.
Ugh.
You know, it just, this issue does not work for me. And so I'm already out on this book. So we're between Thor and Amazing Spider-Man, I'm going to save like $10 a month in comic books. But one book that continues to entertain.
Well, hold on. I'm just going to put one thing out, because I'm going to read a second issue because I'm so interested in the criminal element. But I would like to point out for all, some of us on this podcast, maybe not Paul, have a soft side in our heart for pets and what happens to pets in comic books. I'd like to point out that Tombstone sheltered his cat through an explosion that destroyed his entire home. Fair. And saved it and brought it out alive, which I thought was a high point in the book.
But, you know, I did get from a writing character standpoint that was what pissed him off even more than his home being destroyed.
Oh, yeah.
Was that his cat was at risk. Now shit's gone down. Now there's a gang war.
They shouldn't have endangered his cat.
Yeah, yep. I love that moment, that beat. But go on, Paul. You were going to segue us into Silver Surfer, I think.
I do love Tombstone in the book.
I do,
yes,
too.
Yes.
So another book. No. I will say it was a big Marvel week, which is unusual for me. But, you know, a lot of them were just new storylines and things like that. But Silver Surfer Rebirth, you know, continuing the Ron Mars, Ron Lim storyline, you know, continue this weekend. Aaron, you felt you immediately wanted to talk about this, which I found intriguing.
I just love this book.
It's so good.
I mean, the opening page with the four different Silver Surfers, you know, you've got the Kirby Silver Surfer, the Mobius Silver Surfer, the All Red Silver Surfer, and I forget the fourth Silver Surfer. But how spot on Ron Lim's illustration is of these guys is great. And I mean, the book is just a whole lot of fun. And Ron Lim, I mean, oh my God, the guy is just drawing his guts out in this book. It is a gorgeous book. And don't get me wrong, I think the writing is terrific. But you could take the word bubbles off of this book, and I would still buy it because it is supremely gorgeous. I like how he's handling all the characters, including Tyrant and Jack of Hearts. I will say the Jack of Hearts storyline in this book is confusing to me, given that Jack of Hearts is currently in She-Hulk. But, you know, I think you nailed it in our private Funny Books chat that it's out of continuity, that this Jack of Hearts is not the Jack of Hearts that we're, you know, reading in the pages of She-Hulk. Because that part of it, because they both sort of come back on the scene at the same time, it is super confusing to me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and to give credit for me, you know, of course, Ron Lim, but I've got to also give it to Don Ho, the inker, and Israel Silva, the colorist, because they really sell. Like, if you look at the different Silver Surfers, it's not just the way they're drawn.
Yeah, they're colored.
The colored, like,
they're inked differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, the coloring, you know, shows almost the different paper styles as well. Like, there's an 80s newsprint looking Silver Surfer that's just a little bit discolored.
And the other artist I was thinking of is John Buscema, by the way.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Jack Kirby, John Buscema, Mobius, and Mike Allred. And, I mean, what Paul's saying, the way that each of those Silver Surfers from each of those artists is drawn and inked and colored is true throughout their remaining appearances. Not just on that first page where they each get a panel. It's a four panel page, and they each get a panel, and you're able to really kind of live in that space to kind of pick it apart. Like, yeah, that's Mobius, that's Kirby. You know, I mean, I spent a lot more time with this book than I normally spend with a comic book, because I was just deeply appreciative of the love that goes into the pages on this book. And the tone of Thanos, you know, so much lately the tone of Thanos is just, you know, murder god, right? I mean, he's just going to murder everybody. And there is a bit of whimsy to this Thanos that I have missed. And that is true of when Ron Mars has written him.
Yep.
And in those stories where we see, you know, Silver Surfer and Thanos kind of being hard traveling heroes. I mean, it's really recaptured that feel from those 80s, 90s stories.
Is this the Thanos that would get in the Thanos copter?
It is the Thanos.
It is. Yeah.
I very much enjoy this book.
I do too. It really recalls the Ron Lim, Jim Starlin, you know, Ron Mars, George Perez era of Thanos as a character and the Marvel Universe. And that's one of my favorite eras of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
And apparently it's a lot of people's favorite eras because we got an entire 10-year arc building up to Thanos, inspired by the Infinity Gauntlet. So, you know, I think this is just scratches me right where I itch and continues to, and I will be very sad when issue 5 ends, but hopefully this book was successful enough that, you know, maybe we'll get more Ron Mars, Ron Lim team-ups in the future.
And I gotta say, I think part of the success of this book is that it's a limited series. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just an ongoing with some nebulous far-off end date when it's canceled. I would love to see, and I would hope to hear an announcement soon that, you know, the Rons are getting back together to do it again.
Yeah, or an Adam Warlock book. Give me an Adam Warlock book.
God, get out of my brain, Paul.
I will be first in line digitally.
I need an Adam Warlock High Evolutionary book hard.
Mm-hmm.
Ron, I need that hard.
We're talking to you, Rons.
Oh, hold on, let me look into the camera. Big Paul, can you make that happen for us?
Creepy. Well, if you're not exhausted listening to this podcast yet, we have one more book to talk about. It was a huge week, and this is half of the books that I bought. But there's still a ton of other books we didn't even talk about this week. It was just so big. But finally, we felt it was worth talking because we haven't talked in a while. Probably because an issue hasn't been released in a while. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Last Ronin, issue 5, concluding, you know, the much anticipated storyline, you know, featuring the return of Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, kind of teaming up to tell this one last story, kind of the concluding Turtles arc. Kevin Eastman, Peter Laird, Tom Waltz on story. You know, layouts by Kevin Eastman and art by Isao and Isaac Escorza and a number of other people. Wayne, I don't like it. It was okay. I was going back to our earlier conversation. I was whelmed about the way the story wrapped up.
Poor Paul, so whelmed.
And maybe a lot of it for me was the art. Maybe. I just didn't... The only part of this book that I liked was when, spoilers, Mikey finally dies in the final battle. And, you know, there's two pages of him in heaven with his brothers and Casey and Splinter.
Yeah, and that was so, like, that tugs at the heartstrings.
It does. And the art was beautiful on it. It was great. I wish they had actually had Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird do the art on it. But regardless, it was beautiful. Great way to wrap up. But the final battle with, you know, the last Oroku, or the last of the Oroku bloodline, and Mikey, just felt silly to me. He's kind of got this nanotech suit that's healing him, and you know, the entire time, and it was a little too
I hate the, like, they did this really crazy blend of we have super high tech in our dystopian society where there's no food and people are starving. It's like, you don't get both. You get dystopian or you get super high tech.
Yeah.
You don't get both in the same city after such a short time. And his suit just really bothered me you can't stab him or hurt him because he's got nanotech and it'll just heal him. And I get tired of that.
Well, and you know, it for me, it's just, you know, so I've been reading Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for a long time, and one of my favorite story arcs is Return to New York, as is probably most everyone's favorite Turtles story arc, which is the one where it ends with the final battle between Leonardo and Shredder, and Leonardo cuts off Shredder's head, and it's just
yeah,
so beautifully told. And it's, you know, for this doesn't hold a candle to that. And for this to be the last Turtle storyline, it leans a little too much into silly science fiction instead of focusing on the fact that this is the Shredder's great ancestor. Like, there's no, that didn't work for me. Like, there was no, that character himself just felt like generic evil guy.
They set up the character's mother to still be there and alive, only to just one panel wipe her out.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like there was no payoff to it. There was a lot of setup through the series that didn't get paid off on. I like that the two killed each other in the fight, but I didn't like the nanotech of the fight. And I don't know, it wasn't as satisfying as I wanted. I love those last few pages. I like that Casey decided to go to her mom instead of get involved in the fight.
Yeah. There have been better, you know, and I have air quotes here, final Ninja Turtle battle storylines than this one. Now, it didn't all go bad, but ultimately, it was, for me, it was just a little, like, it started off strong, but it didn't stick the landing.
Yeah, there was a lot I liked over the overall story. It just, this last battle was not the last battle I wanted.
Yeah.
And so, I definitely didn't need to see another, okay, here's this big giant guy you're going to fight, and now here's this big robot.
Yeah, exactly. It just, yeah, it took a lot of the emotion out of what should have been a much more emotional book. And that's why those last two pages really did work for me, because to your point, it just struck you in the feels to see the brothers happy and in heaven with Splinter, and it was just, yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, and Casey, that part. Jones.
And Casey. So a bummer that the story didn't stick the landing, but you know, it is worth reading if you're a Turtles fan.
Yeah, I think it'll be better in trade.
Agreed.
Hey Paul.
Yes, sir.
What's coming out next week?
Well, after this week's massive book release, next week is a little quieter. From Marvel Comics, we get Spider-Man 2099 Exodus Alpha. I'm not entirely sure what it is, but it features Spider-Man and Ghost Rider 2099. Maybe the epic of the century begins here. Maybe some type of a new Spider-Man 2099 crossover type book. I don't know. So that comes out next week. We also get the latest issue of Shadow War in Batman issue 123 from Joshua Williamson and Howard Porter. And the big new release, Flashpoint Beyond issue 1 from Jeff Johns, Jeremy Adams, Tim Sheridan, and Harmonico. And Michael Janine.
I'm totally in for that.
Yes. Can't wait.
It looks like a lot of fun. Well, hey, we want to know what you think about this week's books, next week's books, and the books after that, but not the books after that. We're not interested in those.
Wait.
Anyway, give us a call, 972-763-5903. That number once again, 972-763-5903. If we use your voicemail on the show, you could win a coveted, valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
Especially you, Big Paul.
Looking right at you.
Right at you. You can also hit us up on social media, IOM Geek on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
So next week and the week after, Paul is not, usual Paul, is not going to be available for the podcast. And what we have been discussing is that Wayne is going to run us through the Marvel Multiverse role-playing game. So keep an eye on your feeds. I expect that actual play to land there within the next couple of weeks. So we may be taking a week off. We're still working on that. So anyway, more to come. Can't wait to talk to you again soon. And hey, Big Paul, call me.
Neil Dalton, if you're alive, let us know.
Yeah, proof of life. Proof of life, Neil.
Proof of life. That is exactly correct.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.